The Guardian.
And now,
Tomorrow Radio. Who knows its nature?
You know that I am your friend. You don't have to do anything.
Stand by.
And curiosity often leads to trouble.
Make yourself free and comfortable. Loosen your clothes, move around, stretch. Stretch like a cat.
The Guardian Radio Hour on MTS.
What a peculiar place to have a party.
Yes, it's the Guardian Radio Hour. Hello. We're here till three in the NTS studio, live from Dalston, East London, to zoom in on another untapped area of musical history, or, in the case of today's show, even theory. So far, we've got Jazzy with Nena Cherry, Gone for Glam with Alexis Petridis, and last week, Bobby Gillespie was here to play us his favourite songs about cheating. But this week, it's time for something different, and a guest who'll be a familiar to a lot of listeners, I reckon. He's made an album, quite literally, from the life and death of a pig. He's recorded 3,500 people biting an apple at the same time. He's programmed beats for Bjork. And he's even turned the Guardian newspaper cycle into a piece of music. It is, of course, Matthew Herbert. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
How are you doing today? You good?
I'm good, yeah. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Well, let's go straight into the first track. On the theme of rhythm this week, it's Howling Wolf, Spoonful. That was Howling Wolf, Spoonful, on the Guardian Radio Hour, written by Willie Dixon and recorded by Howling Wolf in 1960, and made famous by Cream. Is that right, Matthew?
I don't know. Did they do a version?
Apparently they did, but it's not as good as the original.
I'm not much of an authority already. Already my cover's blown.
Uh-oh. Don't worry. No, we won't tell anyone. So this theme that you've chosen this week is about rhythm.
Yeah.
Why were you drawn to talking about that?
Well, it's something that isn't really talked about a lot. And it's something that it's a really important aspect of music that I've had to learn. And I've learnt it from a lot of music that's not, wasn't really in the canon of the kind of music that I knew growing up. You know, I grew up in a little village, very white community in Kent, the '70s, and
so
went to church.
Wasn't really.
Well, it was music. Music, in a sense, was very straight. You know, I went to a little Methodist school and a Methodist church, and it was classical music and pop music and things like that. But so it's something that I had to learn. But also, this last year as well, I kind of realized. You know, you get asked a lot, "What does music? What is music?" You get asked that a lot by a lot of journalists thinking about that's fine. And last year I found a definition that I was happy with, which for me, music is rhythm. It's only when you put one thing after something else that it starts to become music, because any sound can be music, and a single note is a single note, but as soon as you put something after it, you know, does it come after it quickly or does it come after it fast? So for me, rhythm is about, immediately creates a tension between two things or two ideas or two moments, and from that we have, you know, that we have music, and you can't have melody without rhythm.
Indeed.
And you can't even, in a sense, necessarily have harmony. You would struggle with harmony as well, to have complex harmony without rhythm. So that makes sense to me. And also, it's just something that really has a profound impact on how we listen and how we think of music now, but it's really not talked about.
Yeah, why is that?
I think because there is a grand flattening around music, whereas now we can have all music everywhere, music has become like donuts. You know, it's just maybe it's a savory donut, maybe it's a sweet donut, maybe it's got custard, maybe it's jam. It's just something that you have and it's there and it's gone. You know, it's not something that you, well, for most people, that you spend a lot of time. You know, I can't remember the last time I listened to an album all the way through from start to finish. I mean, I do from time to time, but not in the way that I used to listen, or not in the way that we used to listen to music, whether it be going to a live, live concerts or something like that.
Is that because you're too busy flicking through your apps or on your Instagram, Matthew, or is that because you haven't found anything that's really pulled you in?
I think it's just about the way it's delivered, actually, now, which is that I now have, like everybody, you've now got thousands of tracks on your iPod, and so actually you begin to lose interest suddenly. Everything, there's no physical action required. It's not like you have to pick up and change a record or something like that, and so the whole act of consuming music or listening to music has become about a kind of disposable experience. Is it happy or sad? You know, is it that part of your life? And you think about music that surrounds us, you know, apparently 65% of our lives have music now, but you think about what that music is. You're in a shop and the music is telling you, hey, we're a cool shop, buy our stuff, it's cool, it's okay, come in a while, hang out here. You know, you get in a lift and the music's like, it's okay, we're not gonna crash, you know. And you get into a hotel and it's like, hey, come and stay a while, you know. And so you think about the messages that we're getting from all this music that's surrounding us, and it's all telling us everything's gonna be okay, and everything's not okay. That's not what people's lives are really like. I mean, music can serve that function, and it can take us to another place and give us a way out and offer an alternative and all of that kind of stuff. But it's not directly so much engaged with our everyday lives, our struggles with money, our struggles with big policy issues, with climate change, all these stories that we read about every day. Music's just not very good at the moment at dealing with that stuff head on.
Well, I can't wait to get into more of the nitty-gritty with you on this. But first, why did you kick off with Howling Wolf? What does that say about rhythm?
I think something really important changed in the 20th century with regards to rhythm. Two big things happened, one which was recorded music. And the second thing was that people that don't normally necessarily have or previously had access to ways to perform music and in terms of distribution or to a wider audience. So in this case, black musicians didn't really have that opportunity before. And suddenly you hear I think the blues is that really underpins 20th century music. And there is something really so good as well. I mean, we talk about rhythm, but actually the drum part in that track is just mk, mk, mk. And it does that from the beginning to the end, and it doesn't stop. And so if you think about a piece about rhythm, nowadays our assumption is that rhythm is about drums. It's not, actually. And like in that piece, the drums is just providing the frame around which everything else is hung off, and then the music, everyone else just bounces around that. So it's not really about drums, and yet that's what we think, that's what we've come to assume because of Parlex's machines and dance music and things like that. But yeah, so it's a sort of, I feel it's a real turning point in rhythm, is like is the blues, and particularly when it's committed to record.
And the second track that you've chosen, De La Soul, does this fit into this idea as well?
Yeah, we're sort of jumping about a bit to a bit later on, but I think you know, this is a track called Business. It was produced by Jay Dilla, who's a really important, one of the most important hip-hop producers. And maybe we'll talk about him a little bit later on, so that you can stop listening to me talk.
let's hear the man himself. All right, this is The Business.
And bass up the track a little bit, because I want to hear that boops, boops, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you know The Business. Common sense. So with the De La, get all them playoffs. We the rhyme sayers. Huh. Yeah, that's The Business. Ha. Go do it like
See, can another brother cook these delicacies?
Oh, that's how I'm supposed to do my thing, huh? Like, triple it. All right. That's how we do it all the way from Strong Island to Chicago, that type of freestyle of flow. Yeah, it's fluent.
And even the flow. Hey. De La Soul featuring Common, The Business, produced by Jay Diller. This is the Guardian Radio Hour with Matthew Herbert. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
That's a great track.
Yeah, there's a simplicity to it, and hip-hop was such a big thing. It's kind of feels like I feel very lucky, because not only of having sort of lived through a kind of democratization of music technology, but actually since I've been born, electronic music has sort of become possible to do in your bedroom. We've had house music, techno, and then drum and bass and dubstep and all that stuff that followed. But hip hop, I mean, that's such a big thing. And what's really interesting about this is the sort of marshalling of technology,
right?
To inherit or to present new kinds of ways of listening to rhythm. And it's very, very hard to sort of exactly put your finger on why it works. It's a combination of tempo and the space and the sound and where it all comes together. But what's really interesting about Diller is that what an influence he then had on people like Questlove, the drummer from The Roots.
Mm.
And that kind of, that drumming style, the very sort of laid back, slightly behind the beat, that's something that has really gone on to have a huge influence in British musicians. So a lot of jazz players really, you know, I've played with quite a few, and they really take a lead from that sound, sort of sat back, sitting back in the groove. So Diller's had a profound impact on not just hip hop, but, you know, sort of bled out from there and into house and into jazz and, well, sort of all over, really.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about drums. I mean, you know, I'm no expert on modern hip-hop production, for example, but I don't suppose that it uses much live drumming. I mean, now that rhythm is no longer, you know, in modern music, is no longer set by a drummer, do you feel like we've lost something, those sort of human imperfections that make a song?
In some ways we have. If you've done it badly, you lose a bit of that, but it still has to be put together. But I think the thing is, for me, is it's still a dialogue with another human, actually, which is that all these machines are designed by someone. So I think we're going to play some Todd Terry later if we've got time. But, you know, that was done on a EMU SB1200. And that had a very particular swing function to it that nothing else does. And the Diller that we've just listened to, that's almost certain to be done on MPC, which has a completely different feel to it and a completely different sort of swing function to it. And those swings and those functions are all designed by people, mostly in Japan. And so in a way, you're sort of still, it's still a dialogue with another human. They've sort of set the parameters to it for it. So I think it's not just as straightforward that the computers are mechanical and there's a grid and that, although that's obviously a part of it.
Mm.
But it's also a kind of a dialogue as well. You know, it's a dialogue with the people that have made it. And we should never underestimate the tools, you know, and the tools have really shaped how we've made music, you know, to a profound degree. And that's sometimes lost. We sometimes think that music is channeled from some other outer space or what have you, through supposedly genius musicians or what have you, and it just comes out. But actually, you know, it's defined so much by the tools and by the things that we use.
Well, the person that we're going to hear from next definitely seems to have a very different take on those tools and those rhythms. Damon Frost, is signed to your label, Accidental, right?
Yeah, he's someone, Damon is a dancer, is from San Francisco originally, but he's in Sweden now. Someone we put out on the label, on my label. And he's, I just wanted to include it just because I think he's got a really unusual take on rhythm. And it's really, really, as I was saying earlier, it's sort of, it's like dancing about architecture. It's really hard to describe how it's working. It's about, there's, in a way, listening to it, it's about an implied beat almost rather than the beat itself. Because, you know, if you think that in Howlin' Wolf, the first track you heard, the percussion is just like mm, ka, mm, ka, mm, ka, all the way through. Well, this, you'd be hard pressed to actually find something. There'd be something on the one, but, you know, where all the other beats fall in are all implied in a way, and there's a kind of invisible pulse in a way, rather than a something that you can point to or nail down.
It's definitely, you know, it's not the easiest listen, but I think once you get into it and once you get pulled into that rhythm, then it starts to make more sense.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I love about rhythm, and again we'll hear it with the Bill Withers track, is that it has this effect of immediately, if it's an off rhythm or something that you don't quite understand, there's a sort of a logical or mathematical part of your brain, I think, that is drawn into it by trying to solve the puzzle and try and find the pulse in it.
Or in my case, just explodes. All right, let's hear that track. This is 45 Teardown by Damon Frost. Todd Terry and Marshall Jefferson, Party People. And then before that, it was Damon Frost, 45 Teardown. So, you know, quite a lot of exploration of different rhythms here on the Guardian Radio Hour. But of course, I wouldn't expect anything less from Matthew Herbert.
There's something, Todd Terry, particularly this era of Todd Terry stuff, like late 80s, early 90s, is like a really big influence on me. And it's probably something I should stress, actually, in my NTS Guardian Radio Hour, that this is not really a definitive exploration of rhythm. It's sort of music for me that I guess has had some impact in terms of how I think about rhythm.
Yeah,
what I love about that track is actually that's quite an even, so the hi-hat's going tick 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 tick. The thing is that tick 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 doesn't really make you want to dance. It's not inherently funky. That's a sort of, we would call that a 16th feel, and it's quite a straight feel to it. And yet it made us all dance, the combination of all the different elements come together, and how other things refer to that rhythm, or how they place themselves in relationship to that. Whereas something like in a big band, you know, it's swung, it's a very different feeling. So you're still trying to make people dance, but in a completely different way. And in some ways, that was a little breakthrough, if you like, in house and techno, is that people started to dance to music that had very different kind of rhythms to the ones that we would normally, you know, if a big band was playing digga 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 digga,
the body started going up and down rather than side to side. Exactly. Going back to Damon Frost really, really quickly, what I'm interested is that he was a break dancer, or he was a dancer that made music. And I wonder whether you can hear that. There are quite a few producers, contemporary producers now, especially in Chicago and Footwork, who are dancers as well. And I wonder whether you can hear that in their music. Do you think that has an effect?
I can certainly see it with Damon, because he sort of physicalizes his music, and there's something about rhythm which is about, or in this context at least, in the context that I'm talking about today, really, is about feeling something. You know, it's a physical reaction to the music, or shall I say, and that's probably not the right way of putting it, I'd probably say it's about a physical relationship to the music. And it's one of the great kind of disappointments for me, and from quite a few people I know that have become DJs, is that I just don't dance anymore. You know, I used to dance, but it's...
Why is that?
there's something about a self-consciousness about it, of like, you know how it works and you know how it's being put together. And I don't know, it's incredibly self-conscious about it now. And it's a real tragedy. I mean, when you make it, when you're sat in the studio, you can dance around and, you know, but actually, you know, in public now, it's a really odd thing. So, but there is something about, if you're making dance music, about the need at the point of creation to actually be moving or doing something. I don't know. It's not a very interesting point, but there's something about physical, you know, having a relationship with the body and the music that I think is interesting. And I haven't really explained why it's interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm disappointed almost that the idea of you going out to a club night or to experience music and just... And not being able to, for the rhythm not to pull you through, I guess. I mean, is that because you're hearing the same sounds? Is that because...
I think it's just the job thing. I really do. I just, you know, I think if you're a chef sitting down to eat at a restaurant, you're just going to dissect how they put it all together. Or if you're, if you make wallpaper for a living, it's going to be hard for you to look around someone's house without noticing how they've, whether the lines are straight or not. I think it's just one of those disappointing side effects.
Or maybe there just aren't enough people playing samples of Coca-Cola cans in clubs. Like, you did you do that at Fabric once? I did do that at Fabric.
Yeah. Yes, amongst other things.
Oh, brilliant. I love that. So, I mean, from maybe into a rhythm that's a little bit, you know, it's more of the swing, this one.
So is this Count Basie next?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, so Count Basie, Kid from Red Bank. This is a phenomenal execution of rhythm by a group of musicians. I mean, it is, it's utterly extraordinary, really. The thing about a big band is that there's somewhere between 16 and 20 of you, and everybody has to be feeling it. You know, my sort of waffly previous answer about feeling it, there has to be, this is probably a much better place to talk about that, because this is about... people playing quite complex music. It's fast as well, this track. And so, for example, the horn line, I mean, it's like ba 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 ba. So it's accelerating through it, and yet the pulse is staying the same. So the drums doesn't speed up, really. But just the horns are just getting closer to the beat as it goes on. And to have a whole section, to have five saxophone players and four trombones and trumpets all sort of do that together, is extraordinary. And it can, annoyingly, it's something that you can only really get from playing a lot together as a group of musicians.
Yeah.
And it's in a way, this track is also a testament to the sort of structures that supported a big band and musicians at that time, because they were gigging, you know, they were the DJs of the time, out gigging every week, you know.
Just quickly, I have this image of you growing up in your village in Kent. What village was it, by the way? I'm from Kent.
It was a little village called Five Oak Green.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. I don't know where that is, but I'm a Medway girl. I have this image of you growing up in Kent as, you know, sort of getting into house music, going to church, cutting and pasting bits of cassette tape together. How did you get into swing?
It was my sister's love life, actually. Like, she had a boyfriend called John Haffenden.
And, hi, John. If you're listening, hi.
He definitely will not be listening. but he was really into Glenn Miller, and he formed a big band with my sister, and he played the trumpet. That's so far so good. Someone else played the piano, which is kind of in a big band, sort of just about. Mm-hmm. And my sister played the cello, so we're already deviating from the big band. And then someone else played the bassoon, so it was not really a proper big band. But from that, it grew into a 25-piece big band, and then I played piano. That was my first band when I was 13. I played piano in that,
and then you
get to play Duke Ellington with a big band at the age of 13. So
that's pretty impressive.
Introduction.
And then years later, you did it better than John with your own yeah. big band albums. Let's hear Count Basie and his orchestra. This is Kid from the Red Bank. That was Count Basie and his orchestra.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, very good.
People on the tweets, just quickly, coming in. I thought I'd read this one out, Matthew. Yeah. Dropping more knowledge than litter on the New York pavement.
I think what they mean is, like, I'm literally dropping knowledge. Like, I can't...
you can't
keep it. Can't keep it.
Maybe you could drop some knowledge about that last track.
The last track or the next track?
Well, we can do the last track or the next track.
Well, that was Count Basie. That's, I think, yeah, an extraordinary. What's great about that is just the swingness of it. You know, that's something that... doesn't always have to swing like that. But and so what I thought I'd play next would be Duke Ellington. This is his one of his versions of Caravan, which is one of his classics, and it's with Max with Mingus on bass and Max Roach on drums. And you need to listen to what happens at 20 seconds in, because that's the really exciting bit rhythmically, I think, at 20 seconds in.
All right, guys, 20 seconds. You heard the man. That was Duke Ellington, Caravan, of course, which some people might recognise also from the film Whiplash.
Yeah, there's a sort of pretty awful version of it at the end.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
they don't quite nail it. Are you, I imagine that, are you a bit of a Terence Fletcher character in the studio?
I'm impressed you remembered his name. Wow. No, I think that's a really... I know a lot of musicians that are quite annoyed about that sort of representation of jazz music. I mean, I actually enjoyed a lot of the film in terms of the tension of it, but it's not really about music. I mean, it's just a big sweaty willy. You know, it's just sort of men just, you know, it's that idea of, you know, bullying and then just being grateful at the end when someone gives you their approval. But I guess that's, you know...
That was,
I guess, there is some sort of, there is, he does sort of I go against him at the end, I suppose. But music is about collaboration, and the biggest thing is about listening. You know, that's the thing, and you can't do it if you can't listen. And that's why I loved that bit at 20 seconds, because just before they go into it, it goes dunk, 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 dunk. The sort of rhythm changes, then it drops into something really sparse. And they're all over the place, really. I mean, Max Roach luckily puts a kick drum on the... on beats 2 and 4 just to help people along, but actually it's all over the place, and it's not just that, but it's the transition out and to make it feel effortless. And that's one of the hardest skills to learn as a musician, is effortlessness. You know, sometimes you have to really work at that.
Yeah,
I guess that's part of what Whiplash is saying. You know, it's about discipline, it's about craft. But that idea of playing is very, very different from writing music. You know, writing music, John K. Joyce says writing music, playing music, listening to music are three completely different things. And I'd add recording music as well to that as well. And it's really helpful to separate those things, you know. Often when I'm working with musicians in the studio or bands, they like, oh, this bit works great live. Or, you know, when we do this, play live. And it's like, well, actually, the studio, you can do gazillions of things more than that. So maybe use the studio as an opportunity to do something else. And then live is a is a separate and different thing. You know?
This is a real masterclass. I hope there's, well, I'm hoping there's lots of, you know, up and coming musicians listening to this. If someone wanted to come and learn from you, Matthew, and like join in this, you know, I know you've mentored people like Mikatu before.
Yeah.
How do people get in touch with you and do that? Can you teach people?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think this generation's really lucky, actually, which was that when I went to university, I wanted to do electronic music, and there was nowhere. I mean, there was literally nowhere. So if you went to do music at university in the 80s, it was Bach chorales, and that was it, and writing out harmonies. And so I did theatre instead at Exeter.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, drama. I did drama. Did the drama course because then I could do drama and then do my music in the evenings or music for plays.
You took the DOS option, basically.
No, we did a lot of meditation, I'll have you know. It was hard work.
Wowza.
I was very lucky in a way. This generation, I think, is very lucky because it has access to all sorts of knowledges and techniques and technologies that we never had. But in some ways, I think the most important thing is the philosophy of, like, why make music? You know, why, you know, the majority of music on iTunes is never downloaded. So the majority, not just 10%, not just 20%, but the majority of music is never downloaded and never listened to. So why do we need any more music? You know, I've talked about this before, so I won't do it now, but, you know, do we need any more music? Maybe we should stop and listen to, you know, there's more about Rhythm in Caravan or Howling Wolf or something like that than maybe I could possibly do. You know, maybe I should, you know, and I'm part of the problem. Maybe I need to stop as well. So
please never stop, because that would be a travesty. But on that note about passive listening, the next track by Bill Withers, I mean, it's a classic, everybody knows it, but I didn't realise how slow it was.
Yeah.
And really that has a whole load of power, and it does not train you, but it does encourage you to really listen to it properly.
Yeah, and I think I wasn't going to choose this Bill Withers track. I was going to choose something like Grandma's Hands, which has got a really amazing feel to it, or Use Me. There's all sorts of Bill Withers tracks that you can use. But when I was just listening through to it, then I listened to Lean On Me and I was like, wait, this is so much slower than I'd be like, dum, ch, da, 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 dum, ch, da, 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 da. That's the sort of time, right? So you need to hold that in your mind and think where it is. And the effect that it has is it slows you down. But yeah, so if you, where were we at? Dum, ch, da, 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 da. Da, da, da. So you need to hold that. So this is that's how fast we think it is. So now let's play it.
Okay, well, you guys can listen to Bill Withers, and Matthew and I are going to go and practice our vocal duo. Bill Withers, Lean On Me, on the Guardian Radio Hour with Matthew Herbert. So beautiful.
So beautiful, and way slower than we sung it.
Oh my goodness.
So slow.
I heard this thing, you know, that people who speak slower command a certain, you know, power and control. You know, it definitely makes you tune in more, like I was saying before. Yeah. And I think this song definitely, I need to take some notes, basically.
Well, it's just, I think, you know, we really underestimate tempo. That's something that I wanted to include here, because just the fact, just how slow that it's going immediately has to slow you down. There's that great, fact that when a choir is really working, the singers, all their heartbeats start to sync up and they all start to all their heartbeats start to go at the same pace and the same time, and you can really feel how a piece like that can have the effect of slowing down or driving you nuts, of course. you can't enforce something on like that, but what it does just with the choice of tempo, it immediately draws you into a different kind of listening experience. And I think a lot of music could learn a lot in terms of tempo. I think a lot of modern music is too fast, actually. You know, you listen back to Prince and you think about the tempos of songs from the past, they'll invariably be slower than you remember them. And it's sort of something, it's part of our sort of hyper sped up culture that it's, you know, that it's going, that's getting faster and faster. But, you know, he's singing about pain and sorrow. And one of the things that we haven't really talked about, actually, is that this is all, everything we've played so far is black music. And it's something that, you know, I was talking to Alana earlier about this, but something that I'm really not good at talking about race. You know, it's something, I grew up in a racist town, racist village. It's all white, racist school, and it was the 80s. And so I'm not good at talking about this stuff, but I learned so much from black music. You know, it's something that's really something that I don't say enough. And that, yeah, and there's something about variation as well that I think you can see as a metaphor, veering away from just this straight, you know, the straightness of it, you know, with a Howling Wolf, pulling backwards or forwards from a rhythm or a position or deviation from something. And it's a really, you know, rhythm was another way, as well as harmony, as well as content, as well as orchestration, as well as presentation, as well as performance, as well as clothing, or all the package that how black music changed the world. But rhythm is another one of those things as well, and it's something that I feel like we should acknowledge more.
Well, you have a manifesto for making music, which is quite well known. You can find it on your website, lots of great stuff on there, and it's for how you personally approach making music. But what's your manifesto for approaching rhythm making? What are your rules?
I because I work a lot with sounds, the sounds often dictate the rhythm. So right now there's a guy skateboarding behind us, so it's like kubachka, kubachka. So that's the little sound that he just made. So that that immediately, you've got a rhythm there that immediately dictates it. And so you know, in a way, what I'm really excited about is working with sounds, is that it's a different way of telling a story. So that's what was great about The Pig, was making a record out of a pig, which was, you inherit the story that goes with it. So you've got the, you know, when the pig's born, it's a very, very quiet sound. You know, the mother, when she was in labor, hardly made any noise at all. You could just hear just heavy breathing. And the pig came out like that. So this is the sound of a pig being born.
It's the sound of my nightmares.
That was it. So it's literally just it. And so the piece automatically then takes on the rhythm of the pigs. That's your rhythm. You've already got the scene is already set. So yeah.
With your music, is it a lot? Is it more about the process than the finished product? Not that the finished product isn't great, but for you, is it more about that process, exploring a pig's life cycle there?
It's become like that just because I don't want to just make music that is just decoration. And, you know, I feel like the world's going wrong and I want to do something about it. So I feel like my music should attempt, you know, if I've got a public voice, I feel like it should take a position on that stuff. And I think that, you know, a huge revolution has happened in music, which is you can now make music out of absolutely everything, out of the studio, out of
our beautiful harmonies that we just did.
All this coffee cup or whatever it might be. And so it's totally changed what the very idea of what music is. And I feel like I sort of owe it to everyone that we've been playing, in a way, like Duke Ellington and Count Basie or what have you. This is a new language that we can use. And so for me, I feel like I have a responsibility to do that. So so my next record is a nude record. It's made out of transgressive noises of another person's body. So I feel like that is much more exciting to me than a drum machine, even though drum machines can sound completely amazing and will inevitably whip my butt when it comes to bass.
Well, but, speaking of bass, Matthew, the last track that you've chosen to go out on has that in reams. So can you quickly introduce why you chose Benga and Koki's Night?
Yeah, so I was thinking about something more modern, and what was interesting about dubstep was that it reintroduced a kind of, even though it was faster than house music, it reintroduced a halftime feel. So, and what you can hear it in, you can hear it in this track in the Shakers, which are, I won't try and sing them, but they go slightly faster and sort of butt up to the beat, and they keep butting up to the beat. Shushing, 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 they sort of keep butting up. So instead of like shh, they sort of keep butting up to it, and then that helps the halftime feel of it. So even though the track is like dunk 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 dunk, so it allows you to dance two different ways. So it's sort of, for a while, dubstep was really exciting because it allowed a different way of listening to the same rhythm.
Well, I think this track still sounds timeless. Thank you, Matthew. This has been The Guardian Radio Hour with Matthew Herbert. Back next Friday from 2 till 3. And this is Benga and Koki's Night.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.